Welcome to Moolala,
Money Made Simple
on SiriusXM.
Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, you know, I've been talking about the value of financial advice for a decade, specifically ensuring you get value for the money you're paying. But it can be hard to do that assessment on your own. Money Coaches Canada has a new service called the On Your Side Investment Report Card. We'll talk to the company's co-founder, Karen Mizgala, about how it works. Then, estate planning is hard as it is, but what if you're new to Canada? Pia Handal is a partner at Dentons. She's going to be here to take us through all you need to know about estate planning if you're an immigrant. And stewardship. How do you apply that idea when it comes to money? Steady Hand Portfolio Manager Salman Ahmed is here to tell us more. Plus, redefining what success means to you. Laura Gassner-Odding is here to talk about her new book, Limitless, How to Ignore Everybody, Carve Your Own Path, and Live Your Best Life. And Carson Group's Jamie Hopkins tells us how to make retirement income planning a little less challenging. He's the author of Rewirement, Rewiring the Way You Think About Retirement. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Faced with a serious medical diagnosis, sometimes it makes sense to get a second opinion. Well, it might make sense for your investment portfolio, too. That's why Money Coaches Canada has created the On Your Side Investment Report Card service. To tell us more about it is Karen Mizgala. She is the founder of Money Coaches, co-founder of Money Coaches Canada, and joins us from Owen Sound, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi there. How are you?
I don't want to leave Sheila out of this here. Co-founder.
Absolutely. Sheila Walkington is definitely been part of this. And Owen Sound, Ontario, that's not where I normally reside. Normally I'm in BC, but here I am in lovely Owen Sound.
Yeah. Now, before we dive into the report card service, I think it's important for a bit of context on Money Coaches Canada, because your model and your service offering, in addition to the report card, is different than what people would get if they were to walk into a bank branch and ask for some financial advice. Give us the 101 on MCC.
Absolutely. So way back when, Sheila Walkington and myself, we both worked in the traditional financial industry as financial planners, investment advisors. We did insurance, and we eventually both felt very strongly that to be in the client's best interest, financial planning and product sales and investment sales and insurance sales really should be separate. So in 2010, we co-founded Money Coaches Canada, where we offer advice-only financial planning and money coaching. So we don't sell investments, we don't manage investments, we don't sell any other financial products other than education and advice and coaching, so that we can be on the same side of the table as our clients.
And this new report card service, as I understand it, is a discrete piece of work that costs less than a full financial plan. Tell us about what the report card service is and what's intended to do.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, typically the services that we offer for our clients are full financial planning, where we look at all aspects of their personal finances, in some cases their business finances. We look at their retirement plan. We look at their investments. We look at their cash flow. What we found, and we fully believe that a full financial plan is critical for everyone. That being said, over the years, we found that some of our clients or potential clients were looking for something more modular, something more specific around their investments. And so we decided to launch the On Your Side Investment Report Card, which provides an unbiased second opinion on really the health of a client's investment portfolio and whether it aligns with their unique personal goals. So we take a look at their portfolio, determine if it's in good shape. We'll confirm that it is or it isn't, and if it is, great. You then have the confidence that that you've got the right investments and you can move forward and sleep better at night.
How much does it cost?
So it's $600 for a single and $950 for a couple with up to 8 accounts. If there are more than 8 accounts, then it's $125 for each additional account.
And take us through the things that you were looking at. There's a bunch of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So the things that typically trip up a portfolio so that it's suboptimal is things like fees. So a lot of people are paying higher fees than they need to. So we'll look at fees. We'll look at performance on their investments relative to benchmarks. Are you getting the kinds of returns that you should be for the types of portfolio and investments and risk tolerance that you have? How well are your investments aligned with your goals, your values, the objectives that you've got as your investor profile? We look at asset mix. So are you in the right mix of stocks and bonds and cash? Are you in the right geographical areas? Are you too heavily concentrated in Canada, for instance? We'll also look at your what we call asset location, so RSPs and TFSAs, which combination are most optimal for, you know, you and your goals. Look at tax efficiency and tax optimization.
So there's a lot of variables you're looking at. What happens after that analysis is done? Is there some sort of an output or a plan or some recommendations?
So we have a 5-6-page colorful, easy to read, easy to understand report that summarizes, here's what we found, here's what you need to do. And we have a one-hour consultation with an investment coach who will walk you through the report and answer any questions that you might have.
What experience have you heard from clients who have used your report card service in terms of their ability to loop back with their current advisor and improve their situation? Has that led to fruitful discussions, or is the insight, oh, geez, I got to move? I got to go somewhere else.
That's a great question, and I think it's a bit of a 50-50. In some cases, what the report and the process and engaging further with having better understanding of your finances, so you've got better questions to ask your advisor, just develops more confidence for the investor to go and have more productive conversations. In some cases, what we're seeing quite clearly is that there are just too many areas that's suboptimal, in which case then what we would do is identify some different investment management options for the client. We do not manage the investments. We do not earn any commissions or referral fees at all for any referrals or names that we might provide to our clients. We want to be absolutely unbiased in terms of what we provide. We charge professional fees for what we do, and that's where it begins and ends.
If this were an elementary school student and this was a report card on their academic year, they'd have all these different subjects and areas where they could do well or not do well. You can tell that I've got a 9-year-old. When you look at the fees, performance, alignment, asset allocation, and asset location, where would you say it is most problematic? So now that you've done a whole bunch of them, you see, you know what, in most of the cases, this is the thing that's really the problem, whereas the other things are less problematic.
Great question. So where it becomes so problematic that you need to change your current investment advisor or investment solution is typically around fees and around performance relative to markets, appropriate benchmarks. And those are the areas that, you know, we do suggest, especially if somebody just loves their advisor, and even if the fees are high, it's to go back. Perhaps you can negotiate with with your advisor to bring your fee to a more appropriate level, a better value proposition level. That's often difficult because there are constraints that a lot of advisors have just on the basis of what their financial institution,
provides. Yeah, like maybe they can only sell mutual funds. They can't go into low-cost ETFs or something.
Exactly. Well, that's right. And so often that becomes potentially a deal breaker. It's very difficult for people to make that decision. It's like breaking off a relationship with your husband or your wife. And so there's a lot of stress that can come into the equation of A, you know, coming to terms like that there may a change may be needed. But again, these are the kinds of things that we can point our clients, our investment report card clients, and our Money Coaches Canada clients to conversations, how to handle conversations, what things to ask for, what are negotiable and what are not negotiable. When it comes to asset mix or tax efficiency for asset location or even alignment, then those are areas that once you're more informed and you know how to ask for what you need and you develop a bit more confidence and that emerges from this process of looking at your investments with an unbiased professional, then you can walk in to those conversations feeling that they're more balanced, because there's a lot of intimidation and fear that happens in the investment world, in the relationship between advisors and clients.
One last question before we go, and it relates to that fear. So many people would be concerned about even picking up the phone to call you because they feel like, oh, I'm going to unleash a whole thing that's going to require me to move my advisor. Are your clients mostly curious and that's why they're there, or are they mostly angry because they feel like something's not working and they need to check their assumptions and see if their gut is right?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. So far, we haven't had anyone who is angry. I would say that people just want to make sure that they're being smart and that they are making good decisions. They're often realizing, and of course, there's a lot of awareness around fees and are you paying too much in fees in the press, which is great, but it's also a bit dangerous because in a lot of cases, people zero in on the fees and think, oh, I should be a do-it-myself investor,
right,
and they're not suited to that, and then they just go into paralysis mode. So I would say the main reason that clients are coming to us is just this kind of sense of feeling vulnerable, of feeling that they may just not be getting what they should. Just a very quick example, one of my clients that went through this process, $2 million was from an inheritance. She felt didn't have a lot of knowledge, had an advisor that she liked, felt even she could trust him, but she didn't really know why she could or she couldn't. She didn't feel she had enough information to even make that evaluation. Well, it turns out, you know, she really wanted socially responsible investing, and he poo-pooed that. Turns out she was paying 1.8% in fees for a $2 million portfolio, which was way too much.
Yeah.
She, you know, paying $36,000 when really, at the end of the day, she did move advisors and was paying 1%, who was an expert in socially responsible.
Right, right.
And so it was a process, though. It was a process of discovery and not one that necessarily happens overnight. But I would say give us a call. Even if you're not ready, we're happy to chat with you.
Just don't be angry with you. Don't be angry with you.
We won't be angry with you. You can catch
no anger. All good. Karen, I'm afraid that's the time we have. Thank you for joining us.
Excellent.
Karen Mizgala, co-founder of Money Coaches Canada. She was here to talk about their On Your Side investment report card service.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
New Canadians have a lot to learn about living here. For some, the language, but for all, the rules and regulations that affect your money. Estate planning is one area that seems pretty easy to put off. Pia Handal is a partner at Dentons, and she joined us now to talk about estate planning for immigrants, what new Canadians should know when drafting their will. Hello there.
Hi.
What does the law say for people who aren't yet Canadian citizens?
So in most jurisdictions, and Canada, Ontario included in Canada, citizenship isn't the real main issue. It's residency.
Okay.
So if you're here for more than 6 months of the year, you're deemed an Ontario resident, and your estate will be, your estate will be administered here.
What about people who have dual citizenship, but they are resident in Canada? Is that the marker that exceeds or is more important?
Dual citizenship is fine. Also, it wouldn't affect your ability to have your estate administered in Ontario. But with the exception of the United States, they have separate rules. So there's tax complications if you're a citizen of the U.S. That you need to consider. Which is why my main number one thing I want to say to people is make your will and make it with a lawyer.
I keep ramming my hand into the desk to make that point because it's so important. We talk about immigration all the time. Many people come to Canada in some pretty problematic circumstances, mm-hmm. and they leave their home, maybe they leave property in another country. How does that apply? Say you're a refugee who right. left their home in a war-torn country, you pass away in Canada. How does that even get tracked?
That's a very good question. I haven't come across a refugee case like that as yet, but I think in that situation, usually family members will know what somebody had in their home country. And so, you know, you try to find a lawyer, reach out, try to find a lawyer in that jurisdiction to do the searches that are necessary. If it's real property, it's like a house. It's, you know, there's usually a register. There's some record of it. And again, all the more reason to do a will. You can append a list to your will of what your assets are outside of Ontario so that your executor will have an easier time determining and trying to, you know, gather in the assets.
What are pitfalls that are connected to immigrants or new Canadians that might be less relevant for people who have lived here for 10 generations?
Well, I think what's important to remember is if you do make a will here and you've made a will, if you make a will here in general, it covers all of your assets wheresoever situate is the legal term.
Okay.
So everywhere in the world.
So if you made another one on the day before you got on the plane and left it in your home country, it is not valid. It is the Canadian version.
Usually there's a clause that says I revoke all prior wills. So it's really important for people to also talk to their lawyers if they make a will in Ontario and tell them about any prior wills and any assets that are held abroad, because you want to make sure that you don't accidentally invalidate a previously made will in another jurisdiction.
Now, I'm sure you work with all sorts of different clients. Many have a challenge even having these conversations about their own mortality. Have you picked up any themes culturally that we might not really appreciate for new immigrants, that they just think about these things differently or they have a different approach?
Yeah, I think it's really important to be transparent with your lawyer. And I think I definitely do see different cultures. They don't want to talk about maybe a family dispute. So they don't want to say, well, my two sons don't get along, and they name them both as executors. And then you have a big mess once mom's gone, because often mom or dad, the family are the glue that holds them together. And once that person's gone and now you have money in the equation, it gets messy.
Right. And different cultures have a different approach to saving face.
Exactly. So, you know, when you're with your lawyer, it's just you and your lawyer in a room. Everything's privileged. It's confidential. You know, so you need to be very open and honest with them. Another issue I see in certain cultures, too, is the idea of joint property. And, a parent will put their house in the same name as a child. It happens in every community. It's a problematic practice because they trust their children will, you know, sell the house and divide it equally among their siblings. But if they inherit it by right of survivorship, it's still the estate's property, but you have to somebody's going to have to litigate it. And not just all your hard-earned money. You know, I'm a litigator, but I don't want people's hard-earned money coming to me. I want them to go to their families, right?
So what advice do you have on, and I think I know your answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway, when should a new Canadian write their will?
Well, certainly if you're purchasing property, you should definitely do it at that point. But as soon as you can, really. I mean, I think it's important if you're going to be, once you have a settled intention to stay in Ontario, once you know this is going to be your new home, I'd recommend seeing a lawyer and making your will as soon as
possible. So kind of the same standard that you'd apply to anyone. If you're an adult with assets, get a will.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody should just have one.
Yeah,
why are we even having this conversation?
Well, and you might need to speak to a lawyer in your home jurisdiction too, because there's no guarantee an Ontario lawyer can make a will that will be valid. There are international wills that can be made, but you never know. Certain jurisdictions have rules change. And so, you know, it's important for people to make sure that they also have some advice on that end.
What advice would you have for new immigrants in terms of that collection of information? Because I know, I mean, I used to live in the U.S. and it was only the U.S. It was like an hour plane ride away, mm-hmm. but it was more complex because I had different accounts in different places and it was all just more problematic than when I lived solely in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of planners will tell you that it's important to keep a list of your assets that if they are scattered about in different places, so that for your executor. It's also really important to choose an executor you trust, somebody that you can talk to about your assets. I know that's also a difficult conversation sometimes, but it's important because executors have to gather in all of the assets. So there's searches you can do, and there's ways you advertise for creditors. You hire someone like me, and I'll help you find your assets. But it makes that job a lot easier and a lot cheaper.
I can imagine that is a culturally complex piece as well, who the executor is, because in a family without a real lineage value, it doesn't have to be the oldest boy. It can be the person who lives nearby or the person who's best with money, or there can be different criteria. But in some cultures, it needs to be a particular person for reasons that are outside of practicality.
Well, and the other issue too is sometimes you have couples without children that come here from other countries and they don't have family in Canada. And so it's difficult for them. There are options though. You can appoint a lawyer as your trust executor. You can appoint a trust company to do it. They're actually quite reasonable to do. All of the banks have one now. So it's an option. If you don't think you can have those conversations with your kids, it might just be better to have a third party do it.
How do you or Dentons handle the language barrier? So for some Canadians, they arrive and they may be professionally very successful, educated, smart, all that, but they don't speak English sufficiently to engage in these conversations.
A translator, especially for estate planning, you don't want to have a family member in the room if they're a beneficiary, because that could sort of taint the will. So
I would translate differently. Basically, the lawyer said, I should have all the money.
Yeah.
Sign here. That's
yeah,
how it
exactly.
Should work.
Yeah. And translators, I mean, they're very, there's services that lawyers hire all the time. Yeah. And they'll come and they'll be there.
My takeaway from our conversation is that this is it's more simple than I would have thought. Developing the will is hard, but it's hard for everybody versus it's harder for new immigrants. Is that an accurate characterization?
It's just slightly more complicated. But I think if you go to a good lawyer, if you go to a lawyer that does this kind of work, then you'll get the proper advice. And that's the big thing. I see messy wills all of the time that people try to do in a will kit or from the internet. And, it's sad, because then you have to apply to the court and try to sort out a big mess.
Which wastes a whole bunch of time and a whole bunch of money.
Yeah. So, yeah, spend it now.
Yeah.
Have a plan.
And sleep well at night.
Yeah.
Pia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pia Handal is a partner at Dentons. We're talking about estate planning for immigrants to Canada. Stay with us. Coming up next, finding purpose in your career. Laura Gassner-Odding is here to tell us about her latest book, Limitless, How to Ignore Everybody, Carve Your Own Path, and Live Your Best Life. And later, retirement income planning tips with Jamie Hopkins. He's director of retirement research at the Carson Group. Make your commute a little bit more enjoyable, at least I think it will, by listening to Moolala on the go. You can subscribe to our show on any of your podcast platforms, so the next episode will arrive straight to your device. While you're there, write us a review. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
They were probably trying to be helpful. Your parents, your teachers, your guidance counselor, and all the other people who offered solicited and unsolicited advice on your future. Well, maybe their well-intended wisdom on what you should do with your life isn't what you need to get on the right path. Laura Gassner-Odding is the author of Limitless, How to Ignore Everybody, Carve Your Own Path, and Live Your Best Life. She joins us now from Boston to talk about purpose in work and life. Hello there.
Hello.
This is a show about getting a handle on your money so you can live the life you want. And I think there is enormous relevance for both of these topics to come together when it comes to personal finance. Please tell me you agree, or we're just ending it right here.
No, I absolutely agree. In fact, I think that ambition is one of the best words in the English language. It gets a bad rap, but I've decided that if more money, more power, more access allows you to show up better for the people you love and the causes you hold dear, then it's not your ambition, it's your responsibility.
You have had, you could say, a traditionally successful career. You started out in the Clinton White House. You've done all sorts of extraordinary things. What was the personal insight for you that led to this book?
Well, over of that career, 20 years doing executive search, I interviewed thousands of leaders at the very top of their game. They were super successful, which is why, as a headhunter, of course, I was talking to them. But none of them were all that happy, which is why, as a headhunter, they were talking to me.
Right.
And I was so intrigued that if success doesn't equal happiness, well, then how on earth are we going to find it? And so I started looking at the people that I saw who actually were happy, and I started looking at my own career and the specific moves I made in order to find happiness while I found success. And what I realized is that it wasn't fulfilling everybody else's checkboxes on everybody else's path to everyone else's definition of success, but figuring out what actually matters, what actually means something to us, and then leaning into that instead.
You say that means achieving consonance, which is not k, b, d, and t. It is consonance versus constant. What am I trying to say? Consonance? Consonance. It's not consonance. It's consonance. What are the dimensions that you talk about when you talk about consonants?
Well, so consonance is its alignment, its flow. You know, Bruce, you know those moments when you feel like everything that you can bring to bear, the things you love to do, the things you're really good at, are being called upon to solve the problem at hand, and you're being rewarded for it?
Totally, and I look great at the same time. I look great at the same time. Like, my hair is perfect, my pants fit, yeah.
And you're being rewarded in some karmic financial way that is meaningful to you. Those are the moments when you're in alignment and flow, when you're in consonance. Those are the moments when you really feel limitless. And that's really when the what you do matches the who you are. And what I found is that it doesn't actually come down to this question of the brand of the company you work for, or how inspirational the leader is, or if you're getting, you know, wine on Wednesdays at happy hour, although, you know, that does make people pretty happy. Mm. And it doesn't necessarily come down to money. It comes down to what the money means for you. So if you're somebody who likes to take really fancy vacations in beautiful European cities and you can jet in and out, it doesn't take a lot of time, but it takes a lot of money, you're going to want to make more money, but you're not necessarily going to need more vacation. If you're someone who likes to go deep into the woods and spend lots of time communing with nature, it's not going to cost you a lot of money, but it's going to cost you a lot of time. And so if you look at the value of a job, you have to look at the value of the job to you and what that money is going to buy in the life that you want to build, instead of just chasing the fastest and most expedient path to the corner office and the bigger salary and the fancier title.
You break out some of the dimensions here: calling, connection, contribution, and control. A lot of people are interested in control, at least how it relates to, you know, the work-life flexibility that they can have. How does that weave into this idea?
Really comes down to personal agency. It's how much control do you have over how much the daily work that you're doing is connected? How much connection do you have to the calling you want to serve? And that calling, we think about calling as purpose, right? This sort of higher, lofty calling. But calling can be raising a family. It can be building a business. It can be growing a bottom line.
Good, because it's too late for me to become a priest. It's not happening. It's just not happening.
Exactly. So, you know, it is how much can you control that? How much the hustle that you have is impacting the bottom line? And how much can you control the contribution that it's making to your life? So if you work harder, if you work longer hours, if you take on a bigger, a bigger geographic area for, you know, your business, are you going to make more money? And is that money going to allow you to live the lifestyle that you want, build the career trajectory you're looking for? Is it allowing you to manifest your values on a daily basis? And so studies have shown, actually, that people are willing to take a job that gives them more control versus more power, because personal autonomy matters to us.
There are people, there are listeners who will hear the title of the book, who will hear you talk, and mostly what they will hear is white urban privilege. Like, wow, who's this amazing person who can be limitless and do with the heifer the holy heck she wants? How does this apply to people who are struggling to make ends meet? And on many days, they're just happy to have this terrible job so they can make their mortgage payment.
So I would say, number one, we all have things that we can do today. So that means, that's, my son talks about the side quest, right? The side quest in video games. So if the main quest of the video game is to go to the castle and save the princess, slay the dragon, save the princess, if you can't do those things now because you've just got to pay the mortgage, or you've got sick parents, you've got young children, or any of those things that are real, there are things you can do today that are maybe not directly on the path, but are, you know, going to the market and selling your wheat so that you can buy the horse and buy your sword, so that when you're ready, you can jump on the horse and slay the dragon Dragon and Save the Princess. And those are things like watching TED Talks, reading books, taking online courses, listening to radio shows like this. There are tons of things that we can do today that increase our optionality so that when we are able to actually make a change, we can make that change, number one. Number two, I also think it's important to recognize that if what you want to do is to become financially independent, you want to pay your mortgage, you want to put money away for your kid's school, you want to finish a degree, if that's how the work is contributing to your life, then that's actually great. So we have this definition that success has to be these jobs of purpose, these jobs of meaning, these big titles, these big fancy whatever it is. But if there is a life that you want to build, then creating a career, having a job that allows you to build that life can make you limitless because it's actually allowing you to build the life that you in particular are looking for.
You have this great twist on the metaphor of voting and listening to all these votes that people make about how you should live your life. How do we stop, and is democracy dead as it relates to our career?
Well, I like to say it's a benign dictatorship is probably better.
Right.
I think we have to stop giving votes in our lives to people who shouldn't even have voices. And that means all the people along the way who have said, like in my case, gee, you're a really argumentative young woman. You should become a lawyer, right? Of course, I told them that they were wrong.
Well, you're argumentative. Of course you told them they were wrong.
But I was in fourth grade, and then I still created an educational path that put me on a road to law school, where I got there the first day, and I thought, I've made a huge mistake. I don't belong here, because along the way, I was giving votes. And what happens is that when we're 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, we're asked to pick a career, to pick a path, to pick a trade, to pick a college. And here's the thing about being that age. We don't have a frontal lobe at that moment, you know, like the actual part of our brain that determines good decision making. And so we're asked to make these decisions that will impact the rest of our lives before we're actually capable of making good ones. And so I want people to stop giving votes to people who shouldn't have voices, but I also want us all to know that maybe you're 5 years out, maybe you're 10 years out, maybe you're 20 years out, and you're at a place where you go, you know, the life that I built looks right on paper, but it's not actually right for me. It's not affording me financially the things that I want to build the life that I need. And it's okay to change. It's okay because I'll tell you, in 20 years of doing executive search, the most interesting people, in fact, the only interesting people I talked to in 20 years were the ones that made left turns and right turns and U-turns because they were the ones who figured out what they cared about and then found the passion inside of them to go after that.
Wow, I love it. I want to sneak in one more question here. Some people limit themselves because of money. They say, listen, I just can't do it because of this. How can they overcome that specific hurdle?
Well, I think that they need to decide whether or not they want it, right? I feel like money is a resource. Time is a resource. Like when somebody tells me they're busy, I don't hear I'm busy. I hear it's just not that important to me. If it's that important to you, then you will figure out a way to find the money, whether it's doing it a little bit later where you can earn more money, it's giving up other things you don't care about as much, but it's creating priorities in your life so that you can afford the things that actually matter to you and then being okay about the stuff that doesn't.
The book is called Limitless, How to Ignore Everybody, Carve Your Own Path, and Live Your Best Life. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Laura Gassner-Odding is the author of that book, Ignore Everybody But Me, because my opinion counts more than other people. Right? No. Stay with us. Coming up later, Laura will be back to go through the Moolala questionnaire with us. But next, we're going to talk to Steady Hand Salman Ahmed about what it means to be a good financial steward. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can listen to past episodes by so many options. Go to moolala.ca. Go to any of the podcast platforms. While you're there, review us. Subscribe to the next episode. Subscribe to all the episodes so they will be right there waiting for us. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are lots of buzzwords in personal finance: diversification, value manager, growth manager, buy and hold, blah, blah, blah. One that has not yet been integrated into the zeitgeist, though, is stewardship. when you think of the word, you sort of think, oh, okay, let's like taking responsibility for something, taking care of it. How does that apply to money? Salman Ahmed is portfolio manager at fund company Steady Hand. He joins us now from Vancouver to tell us how we can all be better stewards when it comes to our money. Hello there.
Hi there, Bruce. How are you?
That's like a very old world word. How do you think about stewardship and how does it apply to your thinking about money?
Sure. Well, in very simple terms, stewardship is about alignment. It's about whether your partner's goals are aligned with yours. So in the case of investing, your partner is the investment advisor and the investment company he or she is affiliated with. And depending on the advisor, your assessment of stewardship might also extend to the investment companies whose products the advisor is using to build your portfolio.
So what do you need to do to ensure that that stewardship is present in that relationship? What are the sort of questions you should be asking?
Yeah, I think there's five things investors can do, and they require a little bit of homework, maybe a couple of hours, but that's not much when you consider that you might work with your advisor or investment provider for 10, 20, maybe even 40 years. So, one.
Yeah, what are those five?
Number one, ask them to disclose their own portfolio. Now, you're doing this because you want to see how the advisor's portfolio might be different from yours. If your advisor is building your portfolio with a bunch of stocks, bonds, or funds that he doesn't own or he doesn't believe enough to hold in his own portfolio, then that should probably be a red flag, right? Two, you want to check with the regulators. The financial industry is highly regulated. Every complaint is documented, and you can look up your advisor and the company she's affiliated with on the CSA website. So the CSA would be the Canadian Securities Administrator. Mm-hmm. You can also look up their record and any complaints they might have received on IIROC and MFDA websites, which are the two main regulators for advisors. And another great resource, somewhat underutilized resource, is the annual OPSI report. OPSI is just the Ombudsman for Banking Services and Investments. The report has stats for all the complaints OPSI receives every year. It's organized by investment firm. It's really easy to read, and you'll see a pattern. Bad actors will tend to receive more complaints year after year. Three, ask how your advisor gets paid, how their commissions and bonuses are determined. You know the saying, right? Compensation drives behavior. And I'll give you an example. At your local bank branch right now, there is a weekly or monthly target going on. This week, it might be that the branch needs to sell 2,000 credit cards for everyone working there to get a bonus. So you know what their incentive is. Four, ask for a statement. You're looking for transparency here. The statement should be easy to understand. Unfortunately, client statements are often formatted to confuse, something you've discussed previously. You want to see if the provider is transparent with fees, returns, and holdings. And five, simple but important, ask for references. And these five tasks, if you spend some time on, should give you a good sense of whether there's alignment between you and your advisor.
Number one and number five are the most surprising to me. So number one, ask for their statements. Will most advisors divulge that, do you think?
Well, they might not, but you should demand it.
And if they don't, you just walk.
Yeah. Well, if someone isn't willing to share with you how they themselves invest, then how can you know with some degree of confidence that their interests are going to be aligned with yours?
What if their risk tolerance is completely different than mine? So they're heavy into Bitcoin and cannabis, and I'm like a buy and hold guy.
Well, that might be the case. Do you think in that case your advisor will be inclined to have you build a buy and hold type of portfolio, or if their own biases and interests lead them to a different direction, might they not be interested in convincing you to go in that direction as well? Now, what you said about risk tolerance is totally appropriate, and that might be a portion of their portfolio. Bitcoin and cannabis might be a portion of their portfolio. But where the main degrees of difference should exist is on how much of their portfolio is in stocks versus bonds. That really is what determines to a greater degree the difference in risk in one portfolio.
Number five was around references. So I said, like, to call a reference or two. What are the questions that I should ask a reference that would be relevant? Because I'm sure the advisor is going to choose someone who's going to say they walk on water.
Absolutely. You want to ask questions very factual-based questions. You want to ask exactly how often your advisor calls you or provides you the service that you're seeking from the advisor, whether you've had to go somewhere else to get some proof of the advice that they're providing, and what kind of process the reference went through himself or herself to arrive at the advisor that you're talking to as well. That'll give you a good sense of what you need to know.
I love all these five examples. I also live on the planet Earth and know that most people are not going to do maybe even any of those five. If you had to choose just one and you had to be like super evangelical about just one, which do you think is the most important as it relates to stewardship and ensuring that alignment exists?
One and two is something I always push on people. Disclosing, having the advisor disclose his own or her own portfolio and double-checking with the regulators as to the record of the advisor and how they've conducted themselves in the industry.
This is something that really seems to, I mean, aside from the regulatory check, stewardship, as you describe it, lives outside of a regulatory paradigm. Do you think that the more investors who ask these questions will increase the standards in the industry?
I definitely do, and I have some experience with this. In my previous life, I was on a research team at a company called Morningstar, and we engaged in a stewardship exercise where we rated fund companies across Canada and gave them a stewardship grade. And every year, Bruce, fund companies would call us up and say, how can I get better? Mm. It became a competitive thing for them. They would see their score as being a C, let's say, and they'd want to get better. They want to be a B or an A. So they would do what would be necessary to get to that threshold. And we saw this across the board. We saw many investment companies start off with low scores in various aspects of stewardship, but over the years improve. Unfortunately, Morningstar no longer does this exercise, which is unfortunate for investors across Canada. So now investors need to do it themselves.
Right. You don't ask, you don't get, right?
That's right.
Salman, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Salman Ahmed is a portfolio manager at fund company Steadyhand. He joined us from Vancouver. Stay with us. Coming up next on the program, Carson Group's Jamie Hopkins is here to talk about retirement income planning and his latest book. It's called Rewiring the Way You Think About Retirement. I must be because I need to be rewired. And we'll take Laura Gassner-Odding through the Moolala questionnaire. What do you think of the show so far? Pretty good. I'm happy. Hey, send us an email. ask@moolala.ca is our email address, or you can connect on social media as well. We'd love to hear what you think.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You have been putting aside money for retirement for years and years and years and years, and now the time has finally come. You're retired, and you're going to start spending some of that money. Now, there's a big difference between retirement savings and the retirement income planning that you need to do now. The latter can be a lot more challenging for people. Jamie Hopkins is the director of retirement research at wealth management firm Carson Group. He joins us today from Philadelphia to talk about his most recent book, Rewirement, Rewiring the Way You Think About Retirement. Hello there, Jamie.
Hello, and thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I have tried to get the title of your book out accurately about five times, and every time I trip on it, which I guess makes it more memorable. What were you trying to get at with this book, with Rewirement?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you got it right there. I've actually had people get it wrong live on NBC, so that's okay. You did an excellent job.
Phew.
the title of the book, Rewirement, was really the idea that, you know, rewiring the way we think, right, changing the way we think. And that was based off of some research I had been doing for the last about 4 years, testing people in retirement and close to retirement, their knowledge and literacy rates about that income planning, how you turn that savings into income. And what I found out is actually people were far less literate on that than they were general financial planning and savings. So and people hold a lot of misconceptions about it. So there was a lot of things that we need to change to have a more successful retirement.
What are some of the most common misconceptions that you found on the retirement income planning front?
Yeah, one of the biggest one that's out there is the idea that, you know, if you average 8% returns in retirement, you can spend 8% a year. And that's still one of the biggest kind of problems out there. People think, hey, if we get average returns, we can spend that amount and we'll never spend down our portfolio. And there was research that came out a long time ago now, 1990s, called the 4% rule, which really looked at that idea and said, look, you might get average returns, but if you get bad returns in the first couple years of retirement, that could be, you know, make it so maybe you can only spend 4% even if you average 8% over the course of retirement. And that concept, even though it's been around for a while, is still very hard for people to grasp. Mm.
What about the, I'm going to use the word lumpy, what about the lumpy nature in which retirees sometimes need their income in that they have this extraordinary, like around the world cruise, it's a really expensive go-go phase, and then they're quiet and just gardening for maybe a decade, and then they hit this period in which they need full-on long-term care and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yep. How do you plan for income that is not constant?
Yeah, and the reality is, you know, while a lot of the academic models look at this constant spending, it's not what anyone does, right? Our spending's different every year. And also what we see is kind of what you described, and I often call it the smile curve of retirement, that at the very beginning you have this big upswing of spending, you're traveling, right, spending time with family, and then you might slow down, and then at the end you might get this spike due to long-term care and health care. And so part of it is making sure that we actually have a plan for that whole lifetime of retirement, that we understand that there could be higher years of spending and that we're properly insured for that, or we have proper savings for it, however it is that you want to fund for it. Now, I'm a person that does view value of different insurance products in retirement income planning, not for everyone, but for some people, it can help kind of alleviate holding on to all of your assets until, right, that spike at the end. We see a lot of data, spending data shows that that's how people deal with it, is that they're just very, very conservative and they don't spend money because they're essentially self-insuring all the risks of their retirement, longevity, health care, long-term care. So you have to hold on to your assets because you don't know what the expenses are going to be in the future. You don't know how long you're going to live.
What advice do you have for people on the sort of goal at end of life? So should people plan to zero, or should people plan to some sort of a legacy amount, not necessarily in terms of insurance, but because they would like to leave money to their loved ones? How do you think that through?
Yeah, absolutely. So I really always just list that as a goal, right? If one of our goals is to leave X amount to our children, and that's a very important goal for us, that can drive the plan. That can mean things like spending less. It can mean things like using life insurance. It can mean things like gifting over the course of retirement. Now, obviously, the more money you give away, the more money you don't have. And so you have to be cognizant of that, too, that you always have to still take care of yourself through this time period. But legacy goals are very important to people, and that can be built in as one of the goals into the income plan, and then actually helps kind of drive the strategies that we're going to use.
Your book outlines a pretty detailed 10-step retirement income planning process. We don't have time to go through all 10, but if you were to choose one or two that are like maybe the most contrarian or the most important, I don't know, I'd love to hear a couple that you think are most relevant.
Yeah, and simply put, what I talk about that is it's just goal-based planning. Start with your goal, figure out if you can achieve it, set a plan in place, and then review that plan over time. And that's really what we're talking about. If you're saying what's something that's a little bit different, it's actually try to calculate at some point what you might not have for retirement that you need. So what I talk about there is a retirement income shortfall. So is there something where you might fall short? Then how do we deal with that, right? Are we going to change our retirement, our spending, our savings, our investing, or are we just going to live with that risk?
There are people who spend too much, but as you mentioned, there are also people who spend too little given the resources that they have available to them. How do you help people work through this unnecessary frugality?
Yeah, and I would say for a lot of financial planning clients, the millionaires next door, the upper middle class individuals that have done a very good job of saving and had the opportunity to save throughout their life. That's the group that there's a lot of data suggesting that they actually underspend in retirement. And it goes back to the thing I said before. A lot of people are self-insuring for every risk, even if they don't use those terms. And what I mean by that is you're worried about the future. You don't have a great plan in place. So without a great plan in place, you're kind of just wandering through retirement, managing it year to year, hoping that your account doesn't go down. Well, you can actually spend a lot more money if you take some of that risk off the table. And that just means diversification. It means knowing, you know, how to spend money, tax advantages of different strategies, whether you need a higher baseline of income through annuities, pensions, your Social Security system, you know, kind of wherever you are in the world. There's typically some government insurance program there for retirees, and putting that all together. And we actually see once you go through a planning process, we actually see that retirees are happier if they have a written retirement income plan in place. And we actually see they accumulate more money and spend more money. And now that seems a little odd to people, that you can accumulate money and spend more money at the same time. But the reality is if you're sitting everything in CDs and bonds today, you're basically breaking with inflation. And that strategy over a 30-year time period, which your retirement might be, actually handcuffs you with less spending and less growth. So you're actually kind of not being conservative. You're actually harming your long-term future by what feels like a safe strategy.
Jamie, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, you know, I hope somebody gets, you know, once that action item, go out there, improve your retirement, get a plan in place.
Yeah. Jamie Hopkins, the director of retirement research at Carson Group, his book, Rewirement, Rewiring the Way You Think About Retirement. Ooh, look, I did it. Hooray. Time now for the Moolah La Questionnaire. So this is our series of questions about money, kind of a riff on the Proust Questionnaire from Vanity Fair. Laura Gassner-Odding is our guest. She is the author of the book Limitless. Laura, the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
Yes.
How would you describe your money personality?
I have an abundance mentality.
Where do you think that came from?
I believe that I can always make more money. I just can't. I've tried to make more time, but can't do that. But money, I've got confidence that I can make.
Do you remember that from when you were a kid?
No. I don't know that I grew up in a house that had an abundance mentality, but I think that I've somehow along the way gained confidence in my ability to do good work, and I became bolder in my ability to ask for more money about it because I learned that I was selling my value and not my price.
Oh, yeah. Who was your money mentor growing up, would you say?
I don't know that I had a money mentor growing up. I grew up in a house where we didn't really talk that much about money, but I had a mentor when I first started my business who, when I brought him tons and tons of interesting paperwork, collateral, marketing, budgeting, he didn't look at any of it, and he said, "What kind of life do you want to live?"
Wow.
Yeah. What kind of vacations do you want to go on? Do you want to stay at the Ramada Inn or the Four Seasons? And when he asked me how I paid myself, he said, "Stop being such a girl." And he told me that I needed to build a business. He told me I needed to figure out what I wanted to earn and build a business that threw off that amount of money. And anything else I was doing was a waste of time.
Did you take that as a call to action or did you just slap him for such a sexist statement?
I did say I find that statement wholly offensive and exceptionally true in my case.
Right.
Ouch.
Okay, so here's another gender stereotyping one. We'll see if you fit the mold or break it. What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
So my guiltiest spending pleasure is that I come home from a sale and I say to my husband, "Look, I saved 50%.
Oh my God. Yep, you did not break the mold here. You did not break the mold. And what is the sale on? It's for you. You are. This is like Google image stereotypes on women, and you have just fit one. Oh, dear. What was your worst financial mistake?
When I first started my company, I forgot. I didn't even realize that I was supposed to pay taxes.
I did the same thing.
I mean, we were doing a renovation on our house. I had my business was doing great, and then we got the tax bill, and all of a sudden I was like, "Wait, what?" And we had $17 in the bank account when we paid our taxes that year.
When will you, air quotes, retire? Because I know you're going to say, "I'm never going to retire." But when will you do something slightly different, and what might that look like? If you were to answer that very broad question with 12,000 caveats.
Oh, Okay, well, I will tell you that I retired from the executive search firm that I founded and ran for 15 years and didn't really expect to do anything specific for a while, and then I got asked to speak in public, which I'd never done before, and then that turned into this career that I wasn't expecting, writing this book that I didn't mean to write, and so I feel like I've kind of already had a retirement, and now I'm just kind of riding this wave as long as the market wants me.
Wow. What, if you think about your financial behaviors, are there any that you'd say you still work on, or does abundance and your abundance mindset really carry the day?
I have an abundance mindset about generosity towards others. I don't have it as much for myself, and I think I still waste a lot of money being cheap.
Ah, right. That's sale thing.
Yes, like I drive around for a half hour trying to find the dollar off.
Yeah.
Like I'll spend 5 hours on the internet looking for the right deal to save 10% when I could have made that money four times over during that time.
You've been married for about how long?
1,000 years.
1,000 and 1,500 years. What is one thing you and your
–
what did you say 21?
21.
What is one thing you and your husband are like, yep, totally aligned on, rock and roll, and what is one thing where there could be some marital tension?
I think we are quite aligned on the abundance mentality in terms of philanthropy and generosity towards others. We have an exceptionally privileged and blessed life that we have worked really hard for, but we also started on third base, right? I mean, I want to acknowledge that we have a ton of privilege. I'll tell you, the first fight we had in our marriage was about getting a cleaning person for the house. I used to travel a ton. I still travel, but when I first started working, I was traveling a ton, and I would come home, and the apartment would be disgusting. And I'd be like, why didn't you clean it? And he goes, I didn't notice it. And I said, but can't you see it now? He goes, you just noticed the dirt earlier than I do. And so I said, but if you know I'm going to notice it before you, why don't you clean it? He's like, because I didn't notice it. And I remember in that moment thinking about my grandmother's wisdom, which is that that a cleaning person is marital insurance.
Oh, yeah. That is a great way to think about it.
We need a maid. It's cheaper than divorce.
Yes, in so many ways. What is the one, so you have two kids, what is the one value around money that you want to ensure is locked and loaded before they leave your home?
I want to make sure that I'm raising two white males in relatively well-to-do circumstances, and I want them to understand that they are going to have the privilege and the burden to help other people decide what they're going to pay them, what they're worth, and I want them to understand that there is a difference between price and value.
So good. Laura, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom.
Thank you for having me. This was super fun.
Laura Gassner-Otting, the author of the book called Limitless. That is our show for today. Subscribe to the show on your podcast platform. Write us a review. If you want to connect on social media, I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Mulala on Facebook. We're hanging out on the radio, but I do a lot of TV. I'm the money columnist for CityLine, so you can check out segments at cityline.tv. Search for me or search for the chefs. Their stuff is way better than mine. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.